Aha. Good evening, everybody. Good evening to people who are in the correct time zones, I will say. We're actually running completely on time today.
It's a miracle.
And it is a miracle. It's a Christmas miracle. Yes, we're definitely live. I've seen us go live on our channel. That's perfect. Yeah, it's all great actually. I don't want to jinx it. This is probably going to jinx it, but we've actually been pretty good technically for the past few streams. And as I mentioned previously, I also have Le Fiber internet now. So if needs be, I can push out streams too. So it's all
Yeah.
good. We're here. We're actually doing two in a row. It's happening. We're doing two related ones too, as you can see by our glorious thumbnail. Like, I hate to toot my own horn, but I'm still dunking on V about how bad his thumbnail game is.
Yeah, should be. You should be. You do almost. Yeah, you do all the art so far. I've donated a few pictures that I have on my wall, but I haven't actually gotten around to doing anything myself. Mind you, that's only because my art is on with pencils and paintbrushes only. My computer art sucks. Yours is so good as well. Why break a very good formula? Anyway, enough.
Yes,
Awesome.
enough preamble. Yes.
Yes.
We actually already have a super chat, which allows me to shill the fact that you can send super chats and also Streamlabs, which is pinned at the top. I have full access back to Streamlabs again, by the way. There was a bit of a hitch with that last week. That was our single technical issue. But Streamlabs is still the best way to donate. The link's in the description, and it's the pinned chat comment. So feel free to throw shekels at us.
And we still have
Let's see.
adverts. We are still fully monetized. Can you believe
Yes.
that?
Yes. Actually, it's a good question because Coney Current Year, which I quite like the name, asks if we've read Abolition of Britain by Peter Hitchens. And we will be quoting that. I have
Yeah.
several clips from the book itself. We'll be using it as a source variously to kind of inform the Blair years, since that book was written kind of at the tail end of the Blair years, if I remember correctly.
Peter Hitchens. You know, at the time, I was a big fan of Christopher Hitchens. He was such an absolute savage in debate. But in my older years, as I've wisened up, I've realized that perhaps both brothers are well worthy of note, and perhaps Peter might be even the more based of the two. But yeah. R.I.P. Chris Hitchens, though. Well, he hated Chris, didn't he? But yeah, no, he was a very, very, very savage debater at the time. Bit of a neocon, bit of a
Little bit.
little bit of a
Little bit.
let's bomb
Little bit.
Iraq. But you know, maybe that was because he realized the dangers of Islam.
Nobody's perfect. Nobody's perfect.
Not even me.
I don't know. No. The rightful Roman Emperor is asking, is this the roast of Tony Blair? No, the roast of Tony Blair is when he finally ends up in hell.
Oh, and it can't happen soon enough.
Where he belongs. I know for those of you who lived under a rock from 1997 till 2008, Tony Blair is, I think he's still the longest running British Prime Minister. He only stayed in power that long to become the longest running British Prime Minister,
Yes.
to beat Margaret Thatcher's record. It's quite some vanity. We will be going over the Blair years in this, but we'll also be going over a lot of what he's done since, because despite appearances, Tony Blair never actually went away, and he never actually stopped influencing British politics,
No, he
and
didn't.
international politics.
No, he's still there. He's now informing a Tory government on how to run the country, using what was it, the TBI, which, as I grew up, that was always the Trent Bridge Inn, which is a rather nice pub near where I grew up. But these days, it's something a little more sinister. It is the Tony Blair Institute, which is a quote unquote think tank. A good
It
name
is.
for massive money pot. For Tony Blair to get rich off and spread his arm has grown long, to put it in Sauron and
His
terms.
yes, his arm has grown long indeed, if he can reach these parts, yes. Going back to our Middle Earth election stream there in
Indeed.
Minecraft, yes. Going way, way back there. Oh, good lord. I don't know, there's a lot of stuff that Tony Blair really informs. As I said, last week we did the history of the Forever Wars, and we really had to gloss over a lot of things. We had to gloss over a lot of the financial institutions that got involved in those wars. We had to, like, we got a lot of good comments. I'd actually, you know, people say herder don't read the YouTube comments, but generally you guys are pretty good with them. Yep. Like, you guys leave some really well-informed comments, and some of them were very good on the whole Iraq conflict thing. We're very good on the Forever Wars in general, and we will touch on that because Tony Blair was one of the architects of the Forever Wars. But he's also really kind of, he's almost like the archetypal modern politician, in a way. He was really the founder of this entire era of Britain, this almost like post-everything era, where nothing really seems to matter and no one really holds ideologies outside of power. He was really the poster child of that. I don't know, Trig, do you want to go, let's go back. Let's go way back. Let's go back to 1996 and the John Major years, shall we?
Oh, the most forgettable Prime Minister that Britain has ever had. So forgettable that every time I think about him, I can see his face, and it is only ever the spitting image caricature of him. The little Mr. sort of grey, completely sort of monochrome, no colour on him at all. And he sounds rather boring, and as if he's got adenoids, and he sounds a bit like someone who you could trust to perhaps talk about his MG midget. And how he's been doing work on it recently. And if that was what he was doing, fine, but no, he wasn't. He was just being really, 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 really dull and as anticlimactic as possible. We'd had the Thatcher years. Thatcher was very much a Marmite Prime Minister. People either love him or love her, or they detest her. And if they detest her, they're clearly wrong, and they're clearly communists and should be put against the wall. And if they love her, they are clearly right-thinking individuals. Which might give you an idea of how I feel about Margaret Thatcher, but no. And following this extraordinarily dull and grey period where politics was about as unexciting as politics can get, suddenly we had, well, this character on the scene. And that this was literally the New Labour, New Danger. Was the Tories' actual advert to say don't trust Tony Blair. Actually, it was based as hell. It's one of the few ad campaigns the Tories got right. They knew. They switched his eyes around, they made them glow red. I mean, it's a real boomer tier meme these days, but actually seeing that on posters in the mid-90s, I thought was hilarious. And they couldn't have been more right, because this dynamic, young, flash, he looked exciting, he was exciting, and as a young man at the time, it was like, oh, okay, this is a politician that could be interesting. He looked like a Tory, he sounded like a Tory, he wore a red tie instead of a blue tie, but to all intents and purposes, he'd basically run in after Neil Kinnock had been unelectable for years and had made the Labour Party look awful.
You're right! that's a reference not many people will get, but those who do will enjoy it. You're right! Neil Kinnock at the fucking conference doing that for like 10 minutes. Just... good lord. Oh dear. It's, yeah, the whole thing is that Labour had been unelectable since the late 70s.
Yeah.
Maggie Thatcher had utterly, utterly tanned their hides repeatedly in three elections. And they had been old, stuffy socialists. They'd basically been, you know, Corbyn Labour? That.
Yeah.
That's what Labour used to be, and that's what they were for the entirety of the 70s, 80s, and most of the 90s. They were a, I think, almost deliberately unelectable force. They got very frustrated with what was going on, but I don't think Labour during the time was particularly useful to the elites. They'd fucked up the 70s, they'd had the winter of discontent, they had, you know, it was very much in living memory and very much in public consciousness up until the 90s. what Labour had done to the country in their previous administrations. And like I said, I think really Maggie Thatcher had been a bit of a bulwark against some of the worst that a lot of people wanted.
Yep.
But a lot of the financial institutions and the international money on the capitalistic side of this kind of like oligarchy, technocracy we find ourselves in now. The economic side, they were able to run rampant and outside of really anyone's control, because a lot was handed over and a lot wasn't done under Thatcher. A lot of the financial institutions that New Labour would inherit, we'll come to later, and we'll see, you know, how they managed to integrate them further with the government. But a lot of that ran rampant in the Thatcher years, and not just in a free market capitalistic way, in a consolidating and controlling way. That was the real failure, I think, of the Thatcher and Reagan years, to get a handle on these international elites and the global power base that was being built there.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, to be honest, Reagan and Thatcher had really helped them, because it was the 80s was the era of capitalism run rampant. And, you know, it was the year, you know, you've been in a council house, you should buy that council house, you should buy your property, you should own this, and you should probably even start your own business. You know what? Go out and start your own business, go out and make something for yourself. And a lot of people did, and a lot of people got wealthy, and the 80s were great right up until the stock market crash at the end.
Yes, they were.
The fall of the Berlin Wall in 89 and everything else, and suddenly 92 came along, and Thatcher was out, and we were joining the EU, and everything started to get a bit sort of ugh.
Very ugh, yes.
And the ugh was largely, as you said, it was John Major was Mr. Dull. There was no excitement, no sex in politics anymore. Well, there actually was, but nobody really wanted to think of Edwina Curry and John Major. Yeah, that's a thing, unfortunately. And everyone at the capitalists had run rampant. And you know, and people like George Soros were lurking in the background, waiting and biding their time to stick the knife into Britain, as we would soon find out, and he would start shorting the pound very soon, and England was under attack, and we didn't even really realize it in the 90s, and along comes Tony Blair, young, exciting. You know, looks like a Tory, looks exciting. There was a real vibrant. It's time for change. It was like, you remember when Obama got elected? It's time for change. It was exactly that vibe. And we got the same shafting.
He was like Obama crossed with like Ricky Gervais from The Office.
Yeah.
He really was like the ultimate like managerialist. In kind of both senses of the word. I'll actually be referring back to some of Burnham during this stream, James Burnham. If you hadn't read The Managerial Revolution or a lot of his other books, I'd recommend it. The Machiavellians is good, although Suicide of the West is a bit black-pilled, as you can probably tell from the name. But he talks about the Managerial Revolution. In the 40s, he talks about basically what happening is that politicians really seeing themselves as managers and seeing themselves as people who can manage the country and manage the economy. And they have this kind of direct control over the monetary and especially institutional levers of the country. And Tony Blair is really the epitome of that. He is the politician as upper management exemplar. Mm-hmm. He's really just the essence of that. He's almost like the synthesis as well of what happens when you have too much democracy, or at least too much illusionary democracy. He is the consummate con man.
Yeah.
And managed to be throughout his premiership, as we will see. He was amazingly good at misdirecting people, and people only realizing what he had really done and what had gone wrong when it was too late.
He's also one of the first one of the first sort of instances, if you like, of politicians from the Francis Fukuyama school of the end of history and the last man. From here on in, politics is going to be small incremental changes. Everything's pretty good, and it's all, we're just going to working towards a homogenous global world, and every country will look the same in the future. All the people will be a light sort of beige-ish colour, probably we'll all end up speaking the same language. That's where they were working towards. It was that zeitgeist. And Tony Blair was definitely working towards that. A lot of people had been educated. I know I'd certainly had a little bit of that pointed towards in the 80s, that in the future, that everybody would eventually be there wouldn't be race in the future. There wouldn't be any difference.
Basically, what happened is people took the lyrics to John Lennon's Imagine and turned it into a really terrible ideology.
Yeah, you literally.
It's literally what it is. It's literally we're all going to hold hands, sing Imagine, and all these things that we decided we don't like won't exist anymore. Don't think about, you know, the end point of that. Don't think about the people we'll have to kill to achieve that. Don't think about the absolute horrible dystopia this actually depicts, where all religions are outlawed, all countries are banned, and anyone who disagrees is essentially just removed from society. We're just all going to hold hands and sing Imagine, guys. That'll be great. That's really what it was, and that was kind of the end point of the 90s. That's kind of where we were when Tony Blair got in. You had the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and this great wave of optimism comes over, like, a lot of the Western countries. We got high on our own farts. Really thought we could do no wrong. And into this steps Tony Blair.
International man of action. The thing is, the action. Tony Blair was, you know what, for the first year, maybe the first year or so, actually, of Tony Blair's premiership, the early bit, the late 90s, he glided a little like a duck or a swan. He seemed to be taking everything in his stride, and everything seemed to be going very, very smoothly. And what we didn't realize as people, citizens of England watching this, is that underneath the surface, he was peddling like crazy. He was pushing through so much legislation. People were working overtime like crazy in Parliament to push through everything, and he had such a monumental lead. I mean, it's akin to the lead in Parliament that we have at the present moment with the Tories. There was a huge amount of legislation, and it was all yes straight through. Nobody could say no to it, and the media wasn't even interested in covering it. It was just look at our statesman Tony Blair, isn't he great?
It was another instance of them being asleep at the wheel. Back then, papers like The Sun, the more working class papers, were seen as more red papers. They were more Labour supporting. It's weird because they've switched now. It's, you know, the working class now is a lot more likely to vote for the Conservatives or UKIP or, you know, any of the parties like that, or the Brexit Party, or any of the alternatives that come, you know, that come out of that. Unfortunately, a lot of ours have been sabotaged. But yeah, there's been a big switch with working class politics. Because again, Tony Blair really did. He was the one who forged, you know, ahead with the assistance of the Red Wall in the north of England, but also managed to take some of the home counties and the city votes and things like that from the nice middle class people who thought we needed a change. It really was very much like Barack Obama. He was, again, kind of the slick internationalist and who the media just didn't question.
Absolutely, absolutely. He was the beginning of the, if you like, the middle and upper class socialists. Suddenly, the middle class was looking at Labour and going, perhaps they're the people that will represent me in the near future. And it seemed like the country was united under a new Labour. It was always a little suspicious. I never voted for the guy, but that's because I've always been a little right of Genghis Khan, as some people would put it, but a little more libertarian as well. And I was looking at it going, there seems to be an awful lot of laws. And then there was the Dunblane shooting, and suddenly gun laws went straight out the window. And Well, that was pretty much it for me. At that point, yeah, it was one of the devil incarnate.
One of the first things the Labour government did actually was the 1997 handgun ban.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, it's a Rubicon-crossing piece of legislation because it doesn't just outlaw guns for the public to own, you know, for the normal person to own. It doesn't just outlaw guns outside of ranges. It outlaws the existence of what was classified as handguns in the UK at the time at all. Collectors mm-hmm. couldn't have them. Rangers couldn't have them. Nobody anywhere in the UK, no matter even how historical some of them were, there was actually no historical kind of exemption at first, because a lot of it just wasn't applied because museum pieces they had to be deactivated, but some of them they didn't want to. It was confusing. There was some of it where it wasn't applied. But the 1987 handgun ban was a blanket ban on a huge amount of firearms under that definition. They simply had to be destroyed. There was no grandfathering. There were no exemptions. You couldn't just store your firearm at a range. It had to be destroyed, which really is, again, it's like everyone always says they're not going to take your guns from you, they're not going to destroy them. Well, this is proof that if you let them, they will.
Yeah.
Like the 1997 handgun ban is one of the best examples I can find of why you should stop gun legislation, you know, any gun legislation. At all, because this is the end point of it. This is where it all goes. And this is what happened under the Labour government. You know, this is something, one of the first acts of New Labour was to really put out a signal and say that Britain is not a place where even collectors and enthusiasts can appreciate firearms.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It was just about anything other than museum pieces were gone. You know, the only people then that kept their handguns, of course, immediately became criminals. The whole adage of when you ban firearms, the only people that have firearms are the criminals. Literally, that literally became the case here, because it was, if you kept any firearm, that was it, you're a criminal. And, you know, having grown up in these period of time, there were still an awful lot of guns floating about, and they were in the hands of criminals, dangerous criminals, and there was quite a lot of shootings and various other things going off in various cities, still are, that get brushed under the carpet, because, you know, we don't have guns in England, which we do. He banned the guns, but this wasn't the only Rubicon crossing that was to happen in the late 90s, because something else was cracking off across the channel, which was that the EU was happening, and the EU were desperate to build their new currency and create their new currency, the euro.
Yes, the euro.
And this is something that I've been looking into a lot, because this is there's almost its own stream right here with what happened here, because essentially Germany wanted to float the euro by itself with a little help from its friends. And Germany was very, very wealthy. They had huge reserves of gold. And then a scandal happened whereby some German reporters actually kind of got access to their gold reserves and found that they didn't actually have any gold reserves, because Germany had shipped all of their gold over to America. According to the Germans, they'd shipped their gold to America to be housed in Fort Knox. And when they'd asked for that gold back, America kind of stopped taking their gold, essentially. It's like, what gold? I don't know what. I'll look for the paperwork for that in a minute. I don't seem to have it.
It's down the couch cushion somewhere.
So Germany was in a bit of a panic. And essentially what happened was something behind the scenes, a backroom conversation, which I wish I could find documentation of. But I've been told by several different sources from different people that essentially this is how it went, was that Germany essentially sold their gold to America on the quiet. Okay, fine, you have their gold. Then they'd liquidated their assets. They'd got some cash. They'd done a deal with Tony Blair to buy England's gold. And actually, it turns out Gordon Brown, I've always thought that Gordon Brown needs shooting for what he did here, but he might not have been the most treasonous out of the two here, because essentially Tony Blair wanted to essentially give Germany the gold and use that to float the euro. Gordon Brown came up with the idea of auctioning the gold off in an open market, but he was going to announce it beforehand, and they'd made sure that Germany was the only people around that had the cash. And essentially, they announced that they were going to sell the gold. A couple of months later, they sold the gold. And at the lowest point... I mean, hold on a second. Let's see if I can find the
yeah, the it was. Point. It was the least valuable point.
It was here.
Oh God, yeah. It's worth something like, what is it worth now?
It is worth something in the region of, I think the latest price I've got it here is $1,726 per ounce. And at the time, he was selling it for around about
$200-$300. Oh. But yeah, it literally at the worst possible moment, Gordon Brown and Tony Blair sold off all of England's gold as a way to float the euro that we were supposed to join.
Yeah.
Now,
Gordon
that was
Brown.
The plan.
Yeah, I know. And he'd shifted the gold, basically shifted the gold to Germany. Germany used that to float the euro, and if I can find it here, where is it? Here we go. This is the capital subscription into the euro. As we can see there, Deutsche Bank, etc., they have 20% paid up in capital in euros at that sum there, which is 1.182 billion euros. And down here, England also bought in at 17%. This is the thing. England, Bank of England, rather, here. We are the second largest contributor to floating the euro, even though the total amount that we're third, France beat it, but the Germans bought in at 20%, we bought in at 13%, but the 20% that the Germans bought in at was based on the extraordinarily cheap price of gold that they had managed to get their hands on from England. Essentially, England floated the euro, by and large.
Thanks. That's a question in chat. Yes, Bilbo Balboa, those are current prices. Yes, there will be inflation adjustment, but it's nowhere near the actual increase in gold.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. It was huge amounts of gold, and it was essentially they had robbed the crown jewels of England and flogged them on the cheap. And the taxpayer of England would be significantly more wealthy. Significantly more wealthy now.
Oh, massively, yes. If we had retained those gold reserves, yeah.
Yeah. So, almost treasonous what they did there, because this was an underhanded deal that purely benefited the euro, and EU are still whining and wanting more money off us on a daily basis, even though we floated the whole fucking thing. Excuse my language.
Yes. Speaking of currency, though, I'm going to say we have some donations here within the last 30 minutes.
Oh.
I didn't realize we'd got so many. So we've got 3 donations here from people. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Once again, I will shill, since you guys seem to be donating. Again, we have Super Chat turned on. We are fully monetized. And you will find at the top of the chat, there is the Streamlabs donation link, which is the preferred way to donate. Also in the description, because we get a bigger cut there. But our first donation comes from Dark Ali Rambler. He's donated $5. Thank you, Dark the Rambler. He says, here's a question I put to any YouTube creator I care about. How big of a bribe do I have to offer you to sign the auto-sync form for library? Oh, shit, okay. Also, as an American, I look forward to hearing about someone else's political nightmare from the early 2000s. Yeah, basically, it parallels it. It's,
yeah.
Blair was to neoliberals what Bush was to neocons, basically. He was an inexplicably, at the time, popular leader who he was since viewed as an absolute disaster.
Yes.
It's amazing how well those two leaders parallel each other.
Well, in many ways. Yeah, I was going to say, one was definitely taking, I think they were taking turns as to who was the bottom. to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, basically, yes.
Those two were really close. Really close.
Also, I'm going to start backing up on Library, and I'm going to start backing up on BitChute. That is something I'm going to do now that we're getting bigger and possibly getting more notice. So thank you for the reminder. I will be doing Library, I will be doing BitChute, I will be doing all the services I can just to make sure we have a safe place to keep our archives. Mm. We have a £5 donation here from Scousefish. Thank you there. Evening, gents. How are we doing? We're doing pretty well, but we're currently having to contemplate Tony Blair, so not that well. it's a necessary special because it really does follow on from the whole Forever Wars thing. But yeah, it gives me a bit of a headache. HK9410 donated £5 and said, complete aside, I just want to take a moment to say fuck California for existing and also for some reason never really suffering from terrorism. It is a mystery. We may never know. But thank you there, HK9410. I think you've probably donated like $100 to us by now. So thank you for all your support. And yes, I do have things backed up on an external source. I have them backed up in the magical cloud, and I also have them backed up on a backup hard drive here. So there are archives if our YouTube channel just suddenly disappears. But thank you for the donations, guys, and do keep those coming. But yeah, it's a case of with Blair and Brown, there's a lot to cover.
Oh boy. Oh boy, is there ever. Because we've only touched the first couple of years.
We have. We're really just setting the groundwork here.
Yeah.
Do you want to take the first quote from The Abolition of Britain?
You know what? It is time for that one.
We will be interspersing these throughout the stream, but we have, I think, four pretty sizable quotes from The Abolition of Britain by Peter Hitchens. These are snippets, but yeah, it's a case of this is something I want to thank Duncan for this, who is occasionally on seat of approval and maybe on some show at this point. One of my current housemates, actually. He's currently living in my house. So, well, they they're currently living in my house. It's complicated. I don't know. Do you want to read this quote, or should I trick?
I can read this quote because yes, this is absolutely.
He's speaking of kind of the 1997 election and the subsequent changing of British society here to set the scene.
This is in the very very early preambles of the book. I think it's page 3, or page III, in fact.
Well, it's part 3 of the introduction.
Yes. Once such a coup would have been impossible, because the British people would have been instinctively suspicious of it and rejected it. Yet in the 30 years before 1997 election, a long and profound set of changes in the British way of life had brought to a maturity a generation to whom the past was not just a foreign country, but a place of mystery, which was easier to mock than understand. Born in the collapse of British confidence, which followed the diplomatic, economic, military, religious, and imperial decay of the 1950s, the new culture simply was not interested in the many concerns which the Tories tried to drag into the campaign.
I don't think we have a slide for this, but that's a very astute point that yeah. Hitchens makes there. That this really was the moment for someone like Tony Blair. It really was one of the only times a politician like him would have been possible. And I guess a regime like his would have been possible. Mm. Because Britain was suffering, like you said, basically from Tory fatigue. They'd been in power too long, really. And the Labour hadn't been... It's really, like, the effect today. The Conservatives have been in power too long.
Yeah.
And Labour has been without an effective leader. It is basically, scarily, the same kind of conditions we find ourselves in now, where people just have fatigue of the same government. And no matter how bad Labour was on many issues, they were offering an alternative. They were offering something new, something vague, but something new, like Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And because of the way politics works, because of the, again, to quote James Burnham in the Machiavellians, he talks about the circulation of elites. And he talks about the fact that the new elite prosper if it retains, you know, the democratic trappings, some, you know, faux political opposition, the illusion of a free press, and what they do most of all is they control the circulation of the elites. Tony Blair is not the man on the street. He's a political insider, and was a political insider, and kind of traitor on that. He became very Tory-like. New Labour, like you said, was more like the left end of the Tory party.
He was a Bullingdon boy. He was from the same gang as all the current lot as well. They are, I mean, you've heard me bang on about the Bullingdon Club, very similar to the Skull and Bones, these sort of elite behind-the-scenes sects that happen at universities and set policy for the coming 40 years from their drinking club, essentially. They have their weird little initiations and so on. And God knows what Tony Blair had to put his dick into to get into that club. We all know about David Cameron and his little initiation. So same thing. And I think there's pictures of the two together, along with various other high-powered political people. At the present moment, including Boris at the present, actually. Boris is... They're all part of the same club. And so, yeah, they're impossible to tell the difference, to be perfectly honest. It's which one's wearing the blue tie, which one's wearing the red tie. Because, yes, he's new. He was New Labour. Neo-lib, neocon, can't tell the difference, quite frankly. But they were all very, very globalist. Very... Big vision, vision of horrifying, almost Georgia Guidestones-esque future.
Ah, oh, there's a reference for you. But yeah, people are mentioning Bill Clinton. He kind of was. He was kind of a Bill Clinton-esque figure as well. But it's amazing. Yeah. We talk about Bush because Bush and Blair were such a, let's say, dynamic team for globalism, global governance, and global policing. They were the real kind of, they were the faces, at least, of the Forever Wars. In the early to mid-2000s.
Yeah.
They were the architects of the invasion of Afghanistan, and especially the invasion of Iraq. Or again, them and their administrations were, because, you know, it's, to a degree, Tony Blair and George Bush were both kind of pawns of a lot of people around them as well. They are not complete, absolute rulers. And like I said, they are part of the conditions that the elite wanted around at the time. They are manifestations, both of them, of the left boot and the right boot, to go back to our All Hail the New Boot stream, of the global, of the global hegemony of elites. Tony Blair and, you know, and George Bush on paper shouldn't have got on, but because one was a neocon and one was a neolib, they created this great alliance of, again, it's just, it is complete globalism. And despite the rhetoric, despite some of the Christian conservative leftovers of the Bush administration and some of the heir to Thatcher overtures of Tony Blair, that's what they were. They were the elites. They were the leaders that the elites needed in each country at the time. And they really, really reflected that. Again, establishment incarnate.
Oh, very much so. Very much so. And they were not shy about destroying the country that they were supposed to be leading to drive a greater ideology, a future that they had that nobody else seemed to want. Nobody else wants this. It is really horrendous, and it is horrendous to the indigenous people of every single country, because nobody benefits from globalism. None of us plebs, should I say, regardless of country, will benefit from globalism. It is the separation, the vast separation between the elites, and driving all plebs down to the same level. All plebs will be equal, whether it be in Africa or England or France or America. We will all be equal, which means we will all be in mud huts.
I think the pods. Something I want to touch on quickly, I want to try and get on to the Iraq War and then some of the later Blair stuff in the second half of the stream, because we are probably going to run for the 2 full hours here. There's a lot to cover. But one thing I'd like to move on to is one of Blair's biggest impacts in the UK was the idea of the multicultural society. And the second part of the idea of the multicultural society was the massive ramping up of immigration. The two went hand in hand, really. Again, we'll probably have... There's going to be a Hitchens quote at the end of this, which is pretty fucking... It's not black pill, but it hits really hard. Which I'll probably read at the end of this little section here. But yeah, there is a huge... From 1997 onwards, if you want to get up that... there's a population change chart, which is actually quite a conservative estimate.
I am just trying to dig it up. I've got so many goddamn tabs open for this stream, it's untrue.
There's a Migration Watch article there from Migration Watch UK, and then underneath it there is also a UK population change from something that's actually attempting to debunk it, but doesn't. It's from, like, Full Fact. And they kind of actually have to begrudgingly agree with the whole thing about the impact of immigration in the UK, because it is just a huge amount of our population is led by migrants and the children of migrants. As it says there, over 80% of the increase was due to migration or children of migrants since the 90s. Since 2001 there, actually, but it really has been since the 90s. You can see it really, really ramping up there through the 2000s. That was the, there we go. Yeah, that's another one. This is actually from 2010, which is hilarious, because if you look at that population projection there, they say ONS principal. There's the population change one.
There's the one.
Yeah, but we quickly want to go back to the one that quotes the ONS figures there, the one from 2010, sorry.
Yep.
Because that's funny, because if you look at that curve there, they talk about, you know, net migration of, I think, 180,000, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Some years, I think 2014, 2015, that number was over 500,000. So we are busting past that red line.
Yeah.
Every year has been above that prediction. And that, like I said, that was 2010, and talking about the idea that I think it's less than 35 years now, Britain will become a minority indigenous nation. Nation, you know, it's the idea of, again, it's the nation of immigrants myth. Britain is not a nation of immigrants, or at least it wasn't before Tony Blair got in.
No, and I hate to be that guy, but, I mean, anybody needs to ask what happens to an indigenous population when that indigenous population becomes a minority in their country. Ask an indigenous American what happens when an indigenous people become the minority in their own country. Ask an Aboriginal in Australia what happens. It is never good.
Make sure he's not his petrol first, but yeah.
no, don't be Rama.
I like the Don't Sleep in the Road song, though. My friend Mike, I always quote him. He's got a great quote about this. He's a native Canadian, and his quote is great. He said to me, you know, I'm the survivor of an apocalypse brought on by uncontrolled mass immigration. And he is.
Yeah.
That's what it is. That's what happens. You know, all these people talk about indigenous rights. You know, what about the indigenous rights of indigenous Europeans? I mean, they get very, very angry about that. But,
say that. It's racist.
Or they don't. Yeah, that's white supremacist. It's just, well, surely the people who live in a nation have the right to decide who lives in the nation with them, and have a right to at least forge, you know, a nation that contains the inhabitants that descended from their ancestors. It's just, it's very, you know, you expect to see Chinese people in China. If China was, like, white, you'd be like, what the hell happened here? It's that kind of thing.
The crazy thing is, if the globalists really wanted this light beige race throughout the world, if they really did want that, and, you know, as I said, I was taught this at school. I'm sure you've run into this, you know, geography or whatever lessons that they would use to push this. They would take a look at the world population and go, okay, well, there's this many million or this many billion white people, this many billion Arabs, this many billion blacks. Which do we mix with which to get there? And actually, the best way of getting the globalist dream of a beige world would actually be for white people to go into Africa and breed with black people, sadly. But really, the we are a minority. The white people are a massive minority in the world. And if they want their dream... And globalists, I hope you're fucking listening. If you want this dream that you're looking for, you're doing it the wrong way, guys. You're really fucking it up.
They're doing it. You're not doing it well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just wanted to establish. It's just established facts that Britain, the face of Britain, ethnically changed massively in the 10 years that Tony Blair was in power. It was unrecognizable at the end of it.
Yes. It went from your local chip shop to your local kebab shop. It's as simple as that.
Well, yeah, your local kebab shop that keeps getting shut because it's serving Donna, not the meat, but the person.
Sadly. Really, yeah. And I wish that wasn't the case, but that is actually, unfortunately, too accurate too often.
I have a quick $10 super chat here. Thank you, Neil Morgan. Good evening. What do you guys think Kamala... what do you guys think Kamala will be like when she takes office? Will she ride out the term, or will she actually pretend to be president, using SC because I've been banned from PP?
What do you mean when she takes office? I thought Joe Biden's already referring to her as President Harris.
Yeah, basically she's already taken office. technically halal. Yeah. Sorry, that's quite a good joke. Yeah, the whole yeah, women are technically halal. But it's
long pig. There's a term.
Yeah, but the ethnic kind of changes in the UK are notable under Blair. But yeah. What the other big aspect, I think, which I think I linked last in the link section there, if you go to the archive of the Telegraph article, it's the idea that coupled with this mass kind of demographic shift was a mass cultural shift for Britain to think of itself as a nation of immigrants and a multicultural nation rather than a monoculture. It seems impossible to people now, really, to think of it. But in 1997, when Tony Blair took power, Britain was a monoculture. It was a very kind of ethnically homogenous monoculture.
Yeah.
It was a completely different place than it is now. And that was all done in aid of the society that Tony Blair wanted to create. And it was all done, really, without informing people. Nobody consented to this mass immigration. It was done, really, without people knowing about it. People only realized about it when Blair got out of power. It happened, and it was hidden from the British people.
Yeah.
I remember very vividly, I wish I could find the clip, there's a hilariously, awfully aged BBC news clip of them making fun of all those who said that Eastern Europeans would flood the UK for the benefit system. They went to planes and asked people coming off and asked them where all the Eastern Europeans were. You know, they were making fun of all the people who said, look, you know, a low-wage country like Romania is not compatible with a high-wage country like the UK. And look what happened. You ended up with 2 million Romanians moving out of Romania into Germany, into the UK. It destroyed Romania in many ways. Like I said, I've actually worked over there. And they have a massive... Like, they have an entire generation of young people gone. They can't get laborers. They have a lost generation. They have a diaspora. And they have a shrinking population. And it's destroyed places like the UK and Germany because of just the explosion of cheap labor and the loss of starter jobs.
I mean, as I understand it, V is the most intelligent person in Romania at this point in time.
Which is a terrible, terrible state of events.
Sorry.
But yeah. But the case was that labor did this to, and I think the quote was, I don't think it's in here, but another advisor said they wanted to rub multiculturalism in the Tories' faces.
Yeah.
They wanted to create this open idea of a melting pot Britain, when that's traditionally not what it was. And they wanted to do this in an extremely short space of time. So not only did they want mass immigration, but they also wanted to completely change the culture from a British monoculture to a left, Labour, kind of neoliberal multiculture they really were just importing the politics of the US left, along with importing its kind of racial divides as well, because they created a huge amount of racial tension here in the UK. There were race riots under Labour, and that was just because of the speed they threw these people into the country.
Yeah.
It was alarming if you ever went to places like Oldham, if you went to a lot of places in Yorkshire, some of the places in Greater Manchester, they stuck them in London, parts of the Northeast, basically everywhere. They created these ghettos of people from Pakistan, people from Eastern Europe, people from all over the world. They basically just crammed everyone in that they could. And they did this deliberately. They did this to change the face of Britain. And they did it, I think, cynically, because they thought it would keep them in power.
And it worked for a little while. Only a little while, because what the left doesn't realize is that when you bring in huge amounts of Islam, Islam will vote for whatever serves Islam best. But actually, by and large, they're very, very, very conservative. A little too conservative for most people's. It's a self-defeating method as well, because, you know, the left, they're not bright, they're crafty, they're cunning.
They're not saying their best, yeah.
But yeah, no, they screwed everybody in the country for their own personal, haha, you're going to get multiculturalism whether you like it or not, and your daughter is going to get rogered by an ethnic because, haha, that's the way she's going to like it. Yeah.
Sorry.
Whether she wants it or not seems to be the case, unfortunately. A nightmare. It was a nightmare. And then whilst this was happening, suddenly, back in, when was it, 2001, so, what was the date? September the 11th, I believe it was?
Oh, yes. I think it was, yes.
Yeah. Something quite catastrophic happened. And we all remember that, because this was the turning point where the world went crazy. The world went insane on 2001, September the 11th. Absolutely insane. America had never been hit like that before. And Tony Blair and George Bush took this as an opportunity to push a huge raft of laws in and to destabilize a big chunk of the Middle East in the process, which we covered, last week. But this was really a turning point, because this is the beginnings of the refugee crisis. The immigration, the doors were already open, but they were really opened at this point. And by 2003, we were at war again. And we'd pushed all of our soldiers abroad. And as you said, suddenly mass immigration had gone absolutely insane.
Well, before we get too into the second half of this, which is really the forever wars and then post-UK politics Blair, because we'll explain, he never went away. There's another Hitchens quote here. It's the one about year zero, basically. It's the page 315. I think it's from page 315 of The Abolition of Britain, if you guys are following along there. Because this is really relevant to what we were just talking about. And I want to get this one not out of the way, but I want to show this one to people, because it's a very good quote here by Hitchens. About what was done to the British public and what was done to the British culture and Britain's idea of itself under Blair as well.
Would you like to take this one?
Oh, yeah, sure. No, that's the wrong one, Trigg.
Oh, is it the wrong one?
Yeah, sorry, I'm skipping around a bit here. I want to use that one a bit later. It's the new ideology one.
Ah, there we go. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, sorry about that one. We'll be using that one a bit later, because it's about the hypocrisy of the new left and the elites. There's a lot of good stuff here.
Oh, yes, this one.
Yeah. Let me say, meanwhile, a new ideology was growing amongst the left. The idea that the United Kingdom was an artificial creation of the Hanoverian era, an invention whose time had gone. Linda Colley, I think it is there, in her influential book Britons, helped to make this idea highly fashionable. So, on a more populist level, did the film Braveheart. a misleading hymn to Scottish nationalism, and a one-sided denunciation of English oppression and cruelty. So Year Zero came at last, rather gently and gradually, after many of those who would have been most bitterly distressed by it were already dead. We were alone and faced with absorption into a European superstate, but millions did not care. We no longer spoke, dressed, ate, or behaved as we used to. But the changes had worked their way through our society so quietly, we did not feel as if our way of life had been stolen. Which I wanted to use that one there because, one, that's a hell of a quote.
Yes.
But two, it's just, yeah, that's really what happened. And that was the spirit, really, at the time when we get to the end of the Blair years. Britain had completely changed and people just hadn't noticed. They'd voted in this dynamic leader who they thought was going to bring them into a new age of prosperity and equality, and instead he'd flooded the country with immigrants and taken us to war.
Yeah.
That is really, really just what happened here. But yeah, he changed the face of the country culturally, but he also, and I think what most people bitterly hate Tony Blair for, is he took the UK to war on a series of lies.
Yes. Yes, a series of rather heinous crime lies. And when anyone spoke up and sort of went, well, actually, I'm a weapons expert and an expert in weapons of mass destruction, and actually, no, Iraq doesn't have any, and somewhat nasty things happened to them. Didn't they? Poor old David Kelly.
Poor old David. Oh, poor old David Kelly. We I don't know. Do you want to talk about this one? Because this is a... I don't know. You might want to get up the other background here, because I've got a Forever Wars background of Tony Blair. If you want to get that up quickly, because I'm quite proud of this one.
You're right. Hold on a second.
Some good counter-propaganda tier stuff is what this is.
Yes. Yeah, let's just take the screen there. There we are. That's actually really, really sums up Tony Blair's contribution to world politics. Cities in flames, children and women and people dying needlessly whilst he laughs and rakes in money. Lots
Again,
of money.
All of this was based on a lie. I mean, you can argue all day about legitimacy of Saddam Hussein, whether he was a brutal dictator or whether he was a holdover from the Cold War. He certainly was a British creation.
He was.
We should keep that in mind. But yeah, that is Tony Blair. We talked about the Iraq War previously, but he did thousands, hundreds of thousands, and possibly even, if we factor in the rise of ISIS, millions died because of the decision-making partly by Tony Blair. But yeah, part of the cover-up and the manufacturing of consent for that war, really, was the very suspicious death of Dr. David Kelly. I know you know more about this one, Triggers. Are you going to take this one for a bit?
Yeah, no, poor chap. He's a pretty honest, decent guy. He'd been working in and around the sort of weapons manufacturer and sort of so on industry for a long time. He was a Welsh scientist, an authority on biological warfare. As it says here in his Wikipedia article. And it was strange because all of a sudden he was there talking out and sort of saying some things that were not politically expedient for Tony Blair. And all of a sudden he committed suicide. Rather.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather weirdly in a very Epstein-esque way almost.
It wasn't quite zipped inside a suitcase, former MI6 operative, but it was suspicious as hell.
Yes, I love this. This is an old article from The Guardian, 7 years old, and sort of 10 years on, the death of scientist remains unsolved. They should have put a comma in there for some, because anybody that actually had eyes to see knew damn well what had happened here, that Dr. David Kelly began a walk from his Oxfordshire home that ended the next morning with the discovery of his body, slumped in a wood, dead. The fact that he... Now, there is no evidence, but you know what? Professionals don't leave evidence behind, that's why they're professionals. But he was quite swiftly removed. After, because he was a distinguished scientist who hunted down weapons of mass destruction of the kind used by the Blair government to justify the 2003 war with Iraq, which Hans Brix, the weapons inspector, was over there.
Fuck you, Hans Brix.
Yeah, Hans over there looking for arms, and he didn't find
arms
any.
For the poor.
He'd found nothing. He found nothing, and he was ignored. We went to war with Iraq based on lies, and David Kelly was pointing out those lies, and suddenly he committed suicide. He died.
He did.
He was deaded.
He was an ex-weapons inspector. He had left the mortal coil. He was, in a word, deceased. David Kelly didn't kill himself. We're being retro here, guys. He talks about Alistair Campbell there, too.
It does.
That's kind of a good lead-off. The whole response to the David Kelly incident, the WMD incident, and the real bare naked lies that have been revealed by the war in Iraq and the failure to find even a whiff of chemical weapons, which seems to be, again, the story which happened in Syria. I know they pretended to destroy them and they let the weapons inspectors in, but, they were never really, there were these small, again, Syria has been a replay of the Iraq war and the pretext for it. They've just recycled it wholesale, but no weapons of mass destruction that were used as the pretext for the war were ever found. Yeah. And this was under Blair's tenure, and they kind of kept this going. It's amazing how they kept this going, because 2005 onwards especially, it became incredibly clear that they had just lied to everyone, and they had manufactured pretext for an extremely deadly war they were losing control of.
Yeah.
Tony Blair's...
It did end up being the downfall of Blair, largely. The war in Iraq led a lot of people to fall very, very heavily out of love with their darling Blair. People were already getting a bit iffy with him, and by 2005, as you said, we knew we had been dragged into an illegal war, and blatantly illegal, international law illegal. In fact, NATO and the UN tacitly kind of turned a blind eye to it, but they knew.
Well, we'll see later that they really just...
kind of agreed with it and just let it happen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. NATO and the UN, they at least agreed with Blair as a figure, as we'll come to see with his post-political career. But yeah, it was something that the UN and NATO, you're right, at the time, at least kind of ashamedly just shielded their eyes from. They just weren't looking at it. In political terms.
Yes.
But it mentions here Alistair Campbell. And it's kind of a British political cliche at the time to talk about the age of spin with Tony Blair. But it really was. It wasn't really the age of spin. We can see it as more of an extension of the age of PR. And what Tony Blair did was he positioned himself as kind of the right end of the Labour Party with an overlap of the left end of the Conservative Party. He was the consummate neoliberal, but what he did was a huge amount of PR work and misdirection. Like I said, most of the policies they pushed through were only really discovered and reported on by the media years later. People just didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
And a large part of that was people like Alistair Campbell, who, you know, I think, what's he called in The Thick of It? The guy who played the, was it Malcolm Reed in The Thick of It?
No, the
guy who swears a lot.
Either way.
He was modeled on Alistair Campbell.
Yeah. The thing is, at the time, when they started bringing this out, spin doctors, etc., I was stood there going, oh, well, that's a nice word for lies and propaganda. Trigg, don't be so silly. Just that and the other. You just live in a weird sort of fantasy world where everyone's out to get everyone, and you're so paranoid. But no, I stand by it. The moment you hear spin doctors, lies and propaganda, they're there to deceive you. They're there to mislead you. And the moment someone's a spin doctor, there is only one way to treat them, in my personal particular opinion, and that is with a good sort of 6 to 8 foot of rope. 13, you know.
That's a good point.
A good strong loop, 13 or so twists on it, and a swift drop. But they will lie, and they did. They misled, and the public bought it again. Who was the other one? There was another one that was a particularly nasty character. I'm just trying to remember his name now.
I had him up earlier. He was it's Alistair Campbell, and Alistair Campbell was really the big one.
Minister for Without name? Portfolio is it was his position.
All right.
Which is wild.
Minister Without Portfolio. That's amazing. I tell you what, while you're looking for that, I will take the I'd like to take the moment to read a donation we've got here. We got one from Spicy Chirizex. It's pretty spicy name there. It says, "Hello, gentlemen. Using a different name, but I ordered my first Freedom Stick, and I'm currently waiting on it. No more Steppy, and Sniffy Chev ain't gonna take me property. Good boy. I'd also like to highlight a good comment here I saw from Bilbo Balboa. I like that name too. He said, I don't care whether we get left boot or right boot as long as the boot kicks V. Thank you. Mandelson, that's it. It's Mandelson.
Thank you. Yes. He was another
Mandelson
one. He was
a creepy, slimy bastard.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely evil. If he didn't have an assortment of different children chained up in his basement, I will be amazed.
He looked like evil Postman Pat.
Yeah.
He did. Yeah. Give a picture of fucking Mandelson. He looked like evil Postman Pat. He was an awful, awful man. Dressed up in kind of a boring way. Again, that was the big thing with New Labour, with people like Alistair Campbell, with people like the Spin Doctors, with Mandelson, with Tony Blair, with Gordon Brown. They came across as boring middle managers. There's always been something like slightly odd about the political class, even through like the Thatcher years. They weren't pretending to be like the man on the street. They still had that sense of perceived pronunciation. They still had that sense of otherness about them. They were essentially eccentric weirdos who wanted to be in power for one reason or the other. And that's really how the public treated them. They treated them with a sense of detachment and suspicion that I think was healthy, honestly. And politics was full of more interesting people back then. They really did. They dressed strangely. They acted a bit weirdly, and they came across as the slightly outcast toffs that they were. But with New Labour and with the spin kind of revolution and with all the PR and all of this, something insidious crept in. They really dramatically changed the country, but they did so under the appearance of being boring middle managers. And they did so, as we talked about during the Forever War stream, they did so whilst kind of pretending that they didn't have power. They pretended they were at the mercy of global forces. They pretended to be part of a global community that was acting in a way that they were not solely responsible for. They were merely going with the way the globalization was, in many ways. they really kind of abdicated a lot of their responsibility to institutions, which they kind of just filled with their friends, NGOs they funded, all of this. The illusion was that they were just the middle managers, they didn't have that much power, and the Bank of England and all of this and the other institutions were the ones really running the country in an objective and scientific way. That's where a lot of this scientism came from. And again, it's the most insidious part of it, that they really did just try and fly under the radar by appearing to be somewhat boring.
Mm.
You know, Tony Blair looks like the regional managers of, like, you know, a Top Shop or something. He looks like someone who would own, you know, a couple of Subway's franchises. Mm. He doesn't come across as a Machiavellian figure who would demolish the national identity of the UK for political reasons and line his own pockets whilst doing it. That was the great illusion of Blair. He came across as a slightly greasy used car salesman, but he also came across as, you know, someone who you would trust to manage the car dealership. I think it was the great trick that they pulled off there with New Labour.
Absolutely,
they appeared a lot more harmless than they really were.
Well, it's like Mandelson, who we have a horrific picture of up here. I'm just looking through at some of the articles about it. Anybody that criticised Mandelson back in the day, openly, too loudly, immediately, oh, you're just homophobic. Classic misdirection. No, the guy's clearly evil. I don't care whether he's gay, straight, whatever. But no, homophobic, which is classic homophobic, racist, whatever. Now, let's throw an ist or an ism at it and not actually address the fact that this guy is creepy, slimes around in the background, and seems to be in the room every time something horrific is discussed and put through. And yeah. Yeah, no, it's... As you say, they look boring. They look moderately trustworthy. And meanwhile, they're residing over the destruction of Britain. And a rapid destruction of Britain. We've just had the census. The census was supposed to be as of the 21st of this month. And I can't wait. And at the same time, I'm extraordinarily concerned to see what the result of the census is. And there is only one man to blame for that census, and that is Tony Blair.
They'll probably massage the figures again. I've also just realised they haven't filled my census. I probably should.
Fill it in soon, because they will fine you heavily for it.
Man. I know they will. I need to get that done. Oof. State gonna come after me.
Yeah, you can do it online, so it doesn't take long.
Yeah, I know that. I've got it out. I've got it here. I just realized I'd actually forgotten to do it. Like I said, the big thing as well with them appearing to be these middle management types, whilst also, you know, starting massive international wars. If we can actually bring out that Hitchens quote you brought out previously about the school system, because that's pretty telling. They really did embed themselves in the upper middle class. They were the acceptable face of a kind of muesli munching, Guardian reading, neoliberal, sandal wearing politics. They were just acceptable enough to cobble together this coalition that they managed to, you know, Tony Blair managed to win three elections with. And only because, again, the Tories were happily, I think, in opposition. They really did not make a push for power until the Cameron years. And again, it almost seems deliberate. Again, with the way Labour was in the '80s, and the way the Conservative Party was in the 2000s, in the aughts, they were happily in opposition, and they were letting the Labour Party do the things that they wanted to do but couldn't do expediently politically. And again, not to get too ahead of myself, but we'll see in the Cameron years, they were a continuation of the Labour years, to an extreme degree. In many ways, there was the austerity, there was some slight tweaking with economics, but the Cultural Revolution and the immigration, you know, fire hose that Tony Blair turned on was never reversed. It was never even slowed. I'll take this one as well, if you don't mind.
Go for it.
Yeah, it's you need to switch the quote halfway through. You'll need to be a trigger man there, but it's a bit of a longer one, but it's a good representation here. Again, thank you to Peter Hitchens. I think this one is, if you guys are following along, on page 57 of The Abolition of Britain. excuse me. Somewhere in Britain at this very moment, an otherwise intelligent couple are gazing at their son or daughter and saying, "It goes against our principles, but reluctantly, we will have to go private." They're not talking about some complex surgery, but about schools. Their dilemma sums up the curious attitude of the cultural revolutionaries towards education. They believe, in most cases, with some passion, that education should be used to eradicate privilege and elitism, to spread their gospel of the new society in which everyone and everything is equal. A sort of concrete embodiment of the heinous song Imagine, which has become a hymn of the 60s boomers. It's kind of... I hate to say it, but it really is. A lot of people just look at that and think the same thing. Oh,
it was on the radio earlier today. I had to turn over because my parents are one of those. Especially my mum. Every time that comes on, she gets all teary eyed, and I was like, "Are you insane? Listen to what they're saying. This is awful." No, it's wonderful. No, it's not.
But yeah, however, when it threatens to eradicate their own privilege by turning their children into mannerless, uncultured ignoramuses, they are not so keen. Mm-hmm. They therefore either find a state school in an expensive area of town which elects through wealth, so paying their fees through mortgages, which is, again, a huge problem here in the UK, where the best state schools are basically their catchment areas are bought up by rich people, or they pay fees directly. There is no moral difference between the two, but there is a political difference. Tony Blair could never have become or remained Labour leader if he had paid fees for a school like the London Oratory. But because it's a state, in quotes, school, he is grudgingly allowed to use it, despite mutterings that it is selective and therefore elitist, which, of course, it is. Again, there are a huge amount of... well, a huge amount. There are certain state schools in this country which have parity with the private schools because of how rich their catchment areas are and how expensive it is to live in those areas. Essentially, they become self-selecting as well.
Yeah.
There are some schools who do it slightly differently. I went to quite a prestigious Church of England school in my area that got parity with the local private school. You know, it wasn't somewhere like Eton or Rugby or I don't know. What's another elite school trick? what's another elite school people? Repton. It's not like Repton, let's say.
Yeah.
But it was at least a good education. But
yes.
I recognize that I was someone who was not, you know, my parents couldn't afford to send me to private school. but I was sent to the best state school I could be. And with the state education system here in the UK, there are some very prestigious, quote-unquote, state schools that politicians send their children to because it's a wink and a nod, and that they know they're not going to get fucking, you know... Essentially, they're not going to send their kid to school with a bunch of packies.
Yes.
That's really it.
You know,
they're not going to be in a neo-madrasa, like a lot of schools have become in the north of England.
I must admit, I had a similar experience. Now, you know what? People may know and people may not, may have guessed, etc. Yes, I went to a rather good school. I went to a prep school, and I actually went on to Repton. Let's dox myself completely here. But before that, in between, I went to another school, which was actually out in sort of East Nottinghamshire, in the very, very nice town of Southall. And it's a Minster school, it was a Church of England school, and there was a cathedral there, which makes Southall quite an interesting town. Technically, it's a city, I believe, with a cathedral. But that was an excellent state school. Absolutely excellent. And it wasn't for the fact that I moved out of the catchment area, I'd probably stayed there. And I went on to a, as I said, very, very good school that, same school that Jeremy Clarkson went to. And yeah, beautiful. And you can't compare the difference between that sort of an education and your average state school, which is, I've said this before as well, it's like the difference between the patrician and the slave / working class schooling and education that the Romans got. One is taught to work and learn a trade and respect your betters, and one is taught to think and understand the control systems that are in place in the world that allow things to change and allow people to be controlled. And the state school system that we're referencing here is very much a, here you go, learn a trade and do what you're told. Don't think. In fact, thinking hurts. Have a beer.
Unfortunately, Trey, it's not like that anymore. They don't give him a trade anymore. They don't even get a trade.
Jesus Christ.
That's how it used to be. They don't even give him a trade anymore. No, they just they tell him to obey their betters and good luck at McDonald's. Yeah, so the state school system is pretty dire.
The state school system is needed. I mean, I was aware of it in the 90s when I was sort of, I'd come out, got to university, and I was like, oh my God, people, you didn't have this. You how on earth did you learn stuff at that in that? And they hadn't. And it's been a constant, frightening and terrifying and disappointing experience when talking about education. It is horrifying what we're doing to the youth and now the young adults of this country and of other countries as well. Because it doesn't take that much. They're teaching literally a different syllabus.
Yes, it is.
They could teach the same thing. Everyone could get the same education. It could be a good one. But then again, you'd end up with a whole raft of people that would learn to think and question. And that's no good if you want hegemony over the population, if you want to control everyone. You can't have people thinking for themselves and questioning you. You're their prime minister. We will do as you are told. We will send the people over to your house with the black bags, and you will be disappeared, or you'll be found dead in a woods. Mr. David Kelly, you think you're clever, coming out with dossiers that contradict me, Tony Blair. I will have you shot or strangled or something like that.
It is a big aspect, though. I know when Tony Blair came to power, his mantra was education, education, education. Very famously. And what happened is we had this kind of big expansion of the state apparatus of, like, you know, there's a joke that the UK is a hospital with a country attached to it. But under Blair, the UK became a hospital with a university with a country attached to it. Essentially what happened is he decided that everyone needed to go to university, everyone needed a degree, and that's where the whole lack of trades came from for the working people.
Yeah.
He essentially cut the legs out from under people who would be very happy being bricklayers, plumbers, joiners, which are now very well-earning trades because of the lack of them. You know, you get a good joiner, that man will earn 50, 60 grand a year easily, and he won't pay a huge amount of tax on it because he's self-employed. He's the clever one.
Yeah. You know?
He's the one with the big house, the nice wife, and the four kids. And, you know, he's got GCSE, and he's very happy just having that. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And that is the way that people used to go. And that is, again, that pathway was cut off at the knees by Tony Blair. That is how we ended up with the modern education system we have now in the UK. Yeah. With the Marxist factories, you know, even more so than they were in the 1970s, the universities, because there was a huge amount of money poured into the education system, poured into the institutions surrounding it as well.
And Christ, yeah, just on that, if anyone here is listening and they're in your teens and you're looking at universities, etc., don't go become a sparky, become an electrician, become a plumber. You will earn £100 an hour being a plumber, and you'll be on 50, 60 grand a year. You'll have a house by the time all of your mates that have just gone to university have come out of it with 100 grand of debt. You'll have 100 grand in assets. Seriously.
Yeah, that's what I learned doing engineering. It is a far, far, far better route than a purely academic route. But we're kind of getting a little bit off track here.
There's
one thing I'd like to cover before we move on to post-power Tony Blair, which is the financial crisis. And kind of the real, Tony Blair, I think, saw the financial crisis coming. But,
Kind of responsible for it, if there's...
Well, yeah, we can go through that as well. It was Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. I don't know, you've got a good spiel here, Trigg, so I'll let you take it.
I do, because back in 2008, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine. No, 2007, rather. Having a conversation with a friend of mine who worked in the city in the credit derivatives market. And we were discussing what he was doing and what was going off there. And after he was explaining it to me, my comment was, dear God, if anybody works out what they're up to and actually looks at the books, the whole thing will crash. And he was like, yes, but they're not going to do that. And a year later, that's exactly what happened. Now, to cover this, the 2008 crash, everyone largely blames two organizations in America, which is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were, by and large, essentially mortgage institutions designed to give the common man the ability to buy his own home. And they were going to do that by allowing people to self-certify their mortgages. And this is very, very common and very, very prevalent in England and was becoming very prevalent in America as well. And one of the architects of that was Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. And they were going around the world telling various countries to set up these types of organizations, because it's only fair that the average guy who, you know, they can be trusted to certify how much they know how much they can earn and pay every month. And they should be allowed a mortgage and then allowed the chance to own their own home, which is a good spiel. It sounds very, very Thatcher-esque almost. But what this did was it set up a huge amount of very, very bad debt that was doomed to fail. These people These people were indebted up to the eyeballs. They'd got credit cards left, right, and center. They'd got store cards left, right, and center. And now they'd got mortgages. And these debts, they were bound to default on, and large numbers of people did. And what the financial institutions had done was, with this credit derivative system, was they would basically chop up a huge number of debts, and you would have really good, solid AAA debts that were guaranteed to be paid back, and they were solid. They're absolutely sound, and people were trading in debts, and they would trade in what was known as tranches of debts, which are basically big chunks, big bags of mixed bags of debt on the stock market. And in there would be a whole bunch of AAA debt, and in there they would stuff a big chunk of bad debt. And the idea being that a bit of bad debt would be offset by all of the good debt. And what actually happened was that bad debt, like a rotten apple in a barrel of lovely, tasty, ripe apples, would just rot the whole goddamn barrel. And we had the 2008 financial crisis, where huge numbers of banks suddenly found that, well, they had a hell of a lot less money than they realized they had. Now, this is by and large actually basically because someone opened the books and looked at them. If you didn't look at the books, as we found out so often, the stock market is largely fictitious and it's basically some sort of religion, because as long as you don't look at it too carefully, it seems to work. But the moment you actually look at it and audit it, it's an absolute can of worms. Literally.
I'd like to have a stream at some point on modern monetary policy and Keynesianism in general, but I will have to get Duncan on for that because they're the economist.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's one of really... We're planning a big series, and I don't want to commit to it fully, but I'm hoping to look at basically every era from 1900 to 1950 and kind of show how what we now exist in is the post-war consensus, well, the crumbling post-war consensus really came into existence. But a lot of that really is to do with modern monetary policy. And again, the managerial revolution, I'm referencing Burnham again because Blair is the end point of that. He's the ultimate manager.
And yeah.
A lot of people don't get the financial crisis right. What they think happened is they think Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Goldman Sachs, and all those people got greedy and created this market, and that's what collapsed the economy. That is not what happened. What happened is Bill Clinton... and then George Bush and Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, they went ahead and they told these institutions to lend this money to people so they would feel like their lives were getting better because they could buy their own houses. Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, you're right, they were a huge evangelist for self-certification.
Yeah.
They were that was one of their big things. They wanted people to self-certify their own mortgages. They wanted every man to buy a home, and we would all live on this cheap credit forever, and it'd be a paradise, it'd be amazing. But it was fiction, and we all knew it was fiction, but the government knew it was fiction too. They were the ones selling the fiction. And this, like people blame Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but their market could not have existed without these credit derivatives. And those credit derivatives could not have existed without governments deliberately, turning a blind eye to what was going on for political reasons.
Oh, yeah.
The 2008 financial crisis is due to, again, it is due to the policies of Tony Blair and Gordon Brown and those being, not adopted, but similar policies also coming to be in places like the US. It was a grand, again, neoliberal, neoconservative dream of cheap debt and almost like a managed, planned economy. That if they just kept the fiction going... if them, as the regional managers of the country, could just protect the plebs from knowing that it was all rotten at the core, everything would be fine, everyone would have cheap mortgages, and they would keep getting voted in.
But why was what was the real reason was even more devious, because they knew damn well what was going to happen. They knew this would be result in a crash. And the net result of that would be that the financial institutions would become much more embedded within... politics, because where did they turn? They turned for a bailout to the taxpayer, and the government was all too happy to buy in, and more international finance and national government slash with a view of global government became intertwined in the process. This crash, each time these crashes have happened, we've come ever closer to the globalist dream. And this is it. This was another pushing us closer, ever closer, towards international finance and national government being one and the same, and almost impossible to tell the difference between the two. One is essentially the stage and the actors on it, and the other, well, both in fact, are the director, the guys on the catwalks, the guys on the lights, the director, the actors behind the scenes. They're all paid by the same thing. You only see as the general public the actors on the stage, and you think you're seeing a play. Well, you think you're seeing real life, but what you're seeing is a play, and it's been produced for you by these people. It's not free.
Again, it's,
sorry.
It is really the cycling of the elites once again. What happened is they brought about the conditions that they wanted to cycle out the old elites, and this was really kind of the era that Tony Blair put himself out to pasture, essentially. He handed over his government to Gordon Brown, who, you know, promptly lost an election because no one fucking likes Gordon Brown. It almost, like, Labour basically lost on purpose.
Yeah.
He set them, like, you know, the great leader had left, and he, you know, we must now move on to the next great leader, who was David Cameron, who again was basically just a neoliberal. And he really just, he departed the mortal core of the British politics, but he didn't depart power. But I don't know, I think we should maybe get up the final Hitchens quote before we move on to some of the post politics. Yes, exactly.
Sorry.
Exactly.
I'm having a bit of a moment.
We need some Alex here. And I'm surprised the chat didn't mention Building 7 at all when we had 9/11 up. I'm appreciating your restraint, guys, but we will take a moment to now remember our Lord and Savior Building 7. But yeah, there's the final Hitchens quote, if you do want to get it up, is the one that mentions Margaret Thatcher, because this is quite relevant when it comes to kind of the rotation of power and really what happened in reverse. Here it is, our Lord and Savior. What happened in reverse at the end of the Blair years, because as essentially Margaret Thatcher was put out to pasture, and then John Major ran a zombie government that, despite some spicy posters, really didn't seem to want to be in power. The Thatcher era really did, in a way, bring about the Blair era as a reaction to it. I'll read this final quote then.
Sure.
In a curious and unintentional way, Margaret Thatcher's years gave her opponents the chance to launch a political revolution to match the cultural one. It was she, by her attacks on institutions and customs she disliked, by her impatience with Parliament and Cabinet government, who alerted the left to the great weapon they were neglecting. To this point, the Lady Thatcher's government actually turned Britain into what Marxists claimed it was, but which it had never actually been. It cleverly made, in James Buchanan's novel, A Heart's Journey in Winter. Yeah. Labour's intellectuals, especially the Marxists and ex-Marxists amongst them, understood this paradox and acted upon it. Blair's government wasted little time on the well-worn but inaccurate weapons of economic power, apart from quietly raising levels of taxation. Instead, it reached for the levers of institutional and constitutional change, tugging furiously at them from the moment of its election victory. I would kind of disagree with that quote a little bit. I think that Thatcher appeared to turn it into what the Marxists feared it was. I don't think a lot actually fundamentally really changed, apart from slowing some of the rot and increasing some of the others. And as this was written kind of, I think, before the financial crisis, I'm not sure when was abolition. I need to get this up because it really does. Abolition of Britain. I need to know the date this book was written. It was actually published in 1999. Okay, he was well ahead of the curve. Yeah, this is well before the financial crisis. So Hitchens only saw the first 2 years of Blair's government in saying this. he didn't see the financial levers they did eventually pull. Which, this is amazing from 2 years of Blair.
Yeah, it
he
is.
Really did see him fucking coming. he's right. The first thing the Blair government did, and why it didn't cause much disquiet, was this, they they finalized the complete monopoly of the institutions and basically destroyed Britain's constitution as a means of maintaining its kind of equilibrium. That was a huge thing that they did, but they're right in that Tony Blair, once again, he kind of cycled in, then he cycled out. It was a almost like a planned cycling of an elite. I will quote some more Burnham, because I really think that idea is extremely informative when you realize this is what you're seeing when you get, you know, what was supposed to happen is Barack Obama was supposed to cycle out and Hillary Clinton was supposed to cycle in, but she was too, you know, unlikable. Now we've had Joe Biden cycle in. Again, it is the reason they hated Trump so much is because despite being quite bourgeois and being part of the rich, you know, the money class, he wasn't one of the elites. Hated him so much. But the reason the kind of transfer of power was so smooth in all of these cases was because the people being cycled in and out were the planned elites. And that's really the story that you see with, you know, Blair into Cameron at the end of this era. But we've got about 25 minutes left. I'm going to need to probably go at 11 o'clock, 2 hours stream time. So we should probably cover the post-Blair in a little bit of a brisk fashion. But there's a little bit to cover here. So I don't know, Trick, what do you want to talk about first in terms of post-British politics Blair?
Well, I mentioned it earlier that Blair has not gone. He is far from forgotten, and I did think it was very, very, very... It was almost sick, actually. It was rather a sick move that the moment Blair was out of British politics, he was all of a sudden very definitely into international politics, and after starting a war in the Middle East that is still essentially going on today, the UN made him the peace envoy into the Middle East.
He became Middle East peace envoy to the UN. The same UN that pretended to criticize the Iraq war, by the way. This again shows the complete endorsement of the Iraq experiment by the UN.
Yeah.
That they were completely behind Blair, because when he got out of power, they said, here you go, here's a job for the boys, here's a cushy Middle East peace envoy. You know, the partner in crime of Bush for completely wrecking the place. It really is like a giant fuck you to everybody. It is I think, a vulgar display of international elitism that they made him that. It really is just a signal that this person is in power and there is nothing you can do about it. I mean, I don't think I'm controversial in thinking that, you know, Tony Blair should be put on trial for war crimes. He misled the British public. He lied and he went to war on a false pretext. He is a war criminal. He was instead promoted to the upper echelons of the international elite to go play Middle East peace envoy. It was disgusting.
And yeah, I mean, the hilarious thing is one of the things that he was actually commanded to do was to set up essentially sort of Israel and various other, you know, he was supposed to set up sort of peace treaties between Israel and various sort of countries in the Middle East, and to try and set up peace in the Middle East. Something that he did nothing for, something that he actively worked against, it seems. Certainly that was the end result. And you know what? There is someone that actually has managed to sign a whole bunch of peace treaties between Israel and a whole bunch of Arab nations. And you know who that was?
Donald Duck. No, wait, Donald Trump.
Yeah. Orange Man did in 1 year what Tony Blair completely failed to do throughout his entire commission as Middle East peace envoy. It's madness that this evil, vile, traitorous scum that needs, frankly, David Kellying, Epsteining, And, you know, the day of the rope can't come quickly enough for him, and my God, I'm fed posting at the moment. But Tony Blair needs to go up on war crimes. He was made peace envoy to the Middle East. He did nothing for it. He whispers into the ears of the Arab nations and the African presidents. as we can see there. And he's vile. And now he has his... The Tony Blair Institute, the think tank that now is informing the Tory government on how they should be dealing with the coronavirus.
Well, there's something interesting that happened between that, to kind of go over this a bit quickly, in that what he did is, the moment he became Middle East envoy, he set up something called Tony Blair Partners.
Yes.
If you look, there's an article here from The Guardian, actually, where he resigned as Middle East peace envoy. And he resigned as Middle East peace envoy because what happened is he immediately went around selling his international access to people. I think it was like the president of like Kazakhstan at the time or something, or a lot of those nowhere nations in Western Asia. He was a conflict of interest machine. He was Middle East peace envoy, but he used that position to massively line his own pockets. We probably don't have time to go over it, but there's an article here from The Telegraph, which talks about the fact that Tony Blair had purchased £90 million worth of property at one point, when he was supposed to be on an average salary of £88,000 a year as Prime Minister. And, you know, not much above that as Middle East peace envoy. Tony Blair has made a massive personal fortune out of this. And he made a massive personal fortune whilst he was, quote-unquote, Middle East peace envoy. Because he was able to sell access to people, the final straw was him trying to, you know, do a peace deal with Egypt whilst advising, being paid privately to advise the Egyptian administration. He denied this, but he eventually resigned when it became clear that this no longer could be profitable. Like I said, Tony Blair used his UN position, as a lot of people do when they're promoted to kind of the upper echelons of internationalism, to make millions and millions of pounds undermining the deals he was supposed to do for his own financial gain. That is the real story of Tony Blair up until he was forced to resign as Middle East peace envoy. And again, it's very typical of him. It's very typical of a man who really existed in this complete line of self-interest. A con man. He appeared to be a confidence man, and he was. Tony Blair was, and has always been, a political con man. But he has survived by being a complete establishment stooge.
Oh, yeah. And, once again, I may point out Bullingdon Club. Which. They are...
He's from the same root. He's from the same root as, you know, as we see today with our glorious bumbling COVID leader, with Boris himself. He's a Bullingdon Club boy. Same with Cameron. He is the insider of the establishment. It's laughable he was ever presented as this progressive alternative politician in the 90s. Again, it's a great confidence trick. And that kind of leads us on to his continuing involvement today, Trig, which I know you have quite a lot to say about, so I'll shut up for the time being.
Well, his continuous involvement with the TBI, the Tony Blair Institute, which is...
Yes.
In fact, the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change is its full name, which doesn't sound hideous, horrendous, and... nightmarish, and we've got a whole bunch of articles as well. It's not like it hasn't been noticed that whilst Tony Blair has disappeared from the political scene as leader of the Labour Party, all of a sudden he's back, and he's here to save Britain from Brexit, because you know what? In 2016, the British public, who everyone thought were dead on their feet, Britain's doomed, Britain's this and the other, Britain isn't a real country anymore, it's multiculturalism. God bless us, we stuck two fingers up at the whole lot of them and went, no, suck on it, mate, we're England, we're Britain, and we are Great Britain. And who should immediately jump into action but Tony fucking Blair?
I will back say, this, to yeah, save this is Britain. This is only a year after he resigned as Middle East Peace Envoy. I think it was late 2015. And in the year between this and Brexit, he made a huge amount of money consulting with people like Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
The very people he'd bailed out, the very people he'd been cozy with, and then his successor had bailed out during the financial crisis. It's amazing, how few beats he missed. He was Middle East Peace Envoy with the Tony Blair Associates making huge money, and as soon as that falls apart, he becomes this public figure in British politics again after making another few millions, financially consulting for a year. And he founds the Tony Blair Institute when that becomes it's a real good example of how a charity, quote unquote, is a much better tax dodge than even an international corporation is the ultimate place for unaccountable wealth. Is, it's like the Clinton Foundation. It's that kind of tier. He's done that, and it's not just him for his own vanity. He's still advising British politicians.
Why is Tony Blair driving government policy in 2021? This year. Why is Tony Blair mentioned? Why is he talking about COVID certification? Why is Tony Blair telling Boris Johnson that the general population should have ID cards and a COVID passport? Boris Johnson, back in 2004, is quoted as saying, "If a man asks me for my identification, if I have done nothing wrong, I will eat it in front of him." Yeah, Boris Johnson. I liked Boris Johnson. I voted for Boris Johnson. I was supporting Boris Johnson when he ran for it, because Boris Johnson had got a long history of saying the right things. But now, all of a sudden, he is... I'm not quite sure whether he's sucking down on it or taking it another way, but somehow Tony Blair is inserting himself into British politics once again. And whether or not Boris Johnson seemed to do a big U-turn this time last year when he got COVID. I don't know whether he was nobbled or whatever it is, but Boris Johnson maybe never was the person we thought he was. But all of a sudden, Tony Blair is now, from behind the scenes, dictating almost everything that you have seen that has been nightmarish from the Tory government over the last year and going forwards. If you look at the amount of BBC articles that, a think tank has said this, that, and the other, just pause the screen, scroll down, look for the TBI at the bottom, because they don't like to say it's Tony Blair. They like to say it's a think tank. But yeah, usually on the document...
by the TBI Institute, the think tank for global progress.
Yeah.
Tony fucking Blair. It's maddening what he's doing.
Yeah, it's maddening. It's most of Britain think he needs to be held on war crimes for the illegal war that he dragged us into in 2003. That resulted in the illegal leadership change in Iraq of Saddam Hussein, which resulted in the power vacuum that happened in Iraq, which resulted in ISIL, which turned into ISIS, which turned into the destabilization of our once allies Syria, which turned into a refugee crisis that's been ravaging and pillaging its way through Europe for the past 10 years at least. And
I'm going to say all of this whilst Tony Blair was Middle East Peace Envoy as well, part of it.
Yeah, yeah. All of it. Tony Blair, every single way. There is only one way to deal with this man, and somehow he is going to avoid the rope that he so desperately deserves.
There's no one, Minecraft. I think, in British politics. In Minecraft, yeah.
In Minecraft.
We're going to use a lead. We're going to use one of those leads, yeah. In Minecraft, yeah. No, it's amazing, because I think Tony Blair is actually at this point just wheeled out to humiliate people. I honestly think it is. I honestly think, like I said, it is a display of how powerful they are. I think they know how unpopular Tony Blair is, and I think they wheel him out just to show us that no matter how much we hate him, he will never go away. I don't think he's even that powerful, honestly. All he does is regurgitate what the rest of the elites say. He's a mouthpiece. He's not someone who's actually in power, but he represents them. He is a face, he has a name, and he represents their interests. And he is wheeled back out over and over again to show us that we have no power over our destiny. He's almost like a fucking psyop. He's so unpopular. You know, any institution, any international institution would shut him the fuck up. They'd tell him to go away. He'd be poison. But what they're doing is they're showing he is one of the chosen ones. He is one of the elites. And as long as we exist in this system, he will always get away with it. And he will always be present. And he will always be lorded over us to remind us that we can't do anything. That's what this feels like. It's it's the concept I've talked about before of ritual humiliation. It happens in the US, it happens in the UK, it happens in all these countries that essentially long ago the left won. Long ago the left won. We've had very, you know, tacitly kind of planned economies for a long time. You know, in name only, a lot of Western economies haven't been planned economies. And Tony Blair, again, he was one of the architects of that while in power, and he gets paraded back out to humiliate us. Again, he's a symbol. He's a symbol of unaccountable international power, and that you can never vote these people out.
No. No, you can't, because they come back as some sort of shadowy creature in the background that informs your current actors on the stage, as I said before. When Alex Jones bangs on about the deep state, when people bang on about the deep state, they are talking about your civil service. They are talking about these players that whenever you vote in, who doesn't really matter who you vote in. Good God, I mean, Orange Man, Trump was such a shock to the system that, because for the longest time I've thought this, that doesn't really matter who you put on the stage, they're handed the same script, which is why so many people, when they're voted in, they immediately throw out everything that they've said that they stood for, and you get more of the same. New boot, every single time. It is because the moment they get in, even if they didn't realise what they were letting themselves in for, they're handed a script and they're told, you sing from this script, you perform like the trained monkey you are, or we'll give you COVID, or something bad will happen. You'll have an accident whilst driving through a tunnel in Paris.
Or, more esoterically, and I think slightly more depressingly, even if people do have the will to do something, they'll find that the institutions around them are so bent against it, are so compromised, and so, you know, moving with one voice that they find themselves unable to do something like Trump.
Which is why exactly.
Yeah, they'll find the entire establishment rises up from beneath them and gums up anything they try to do. And a lot of people are saying, please stop with the black pills, this is just fucking depressing. Well, I'm sorry, this is just reality. This is just the reality of British politics right now. That we are so fucked that Tony Blair is advising Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
On COVID passports. And in fact, seems to have made him do a U-turn on COVID passports. But don't get blackpilled. It's, you just have to see this. Yeah. All you have to do is see this and say no. It really is that simple. It's kind of a do not comply. And we'll sure have a COVID thing at some point. But I wanted to do this Tony Blair special because he informs kind of the Forever War stuff so well. And he's a great example of how the narrative about, you know, that the Forever Wars was a kind of a rogue New Labour politician and the Bush administration is bullshit. It has been endorsed all along by the establishment and the elites. Their faux disavowal of it from the Obama years, whilst intensifying it in the background, all of that was performative. And Tony Blair is a perfect crystallized example of that, because he will never be rejected by the establishment, because the establishment love him. He is their boy, and everything he has done has been at their behest. And like I said, he's a, really a symbol of the world we find ourselves in.
Yes. It's not just British politics. It's world politics at this point as well. This is the horrifying thing. And again, don't get blackpilled by it. There is no point in being blackpilled by it, because you can walk out any day of the week. Look outside, birds still sing, the sky is still blue. There are still so many wonderful things in this world. But it's just acknowledging what is going off. And we can always say no. And that's all I ask, is say no. When they say, put this piece of software on your smartphone so that we can tell whether or not you've been near someone that's had COVID, say no. Say no. Say, if you want me to carry stuff like that on my smartphone, you buy me my smartphone. Because you're not putting your data on my smartphone. You're not using my electricity and my property to do stuff that is not for my best interest. Don't buy into it. Don't sit there clapping for the NHS like some sort of trained seal. Yeah? Don't do what they tell you to do. Think for yourself. And no is a very simple word.
It is. I've been watching, do you know who Adam Curtis is? He did Power of Nightmares, Hypernormalization.
Vaguely. Yes.
Yeah. He does a lot of those kind of stock footage voiceover documentaries. I think he misses the point a lot. He's a leftist, but he's kind of a bit of a red pill leftist in some ways. And more recently a black pill leftist, which has kind of been funny to see. It's funny watching some of his old solutions come back to bite him. And just completely failing from a leftward's perspective. But his latest documentary is called Can't Get Out of My Head. And he quotes David Graeber, who is... He wrote The Utopia of Rules. And there's a great quote in there, which I think is... It's inspiring to anyone of, I guess, any ilk, because it really just... I hate the term self-empowerment, but it really just stabs the truth of the way reality is. And he says, the ultimate hidden truth of the world is that it is something that we make, and we could just as easily make it differently.
Yeah.
So if I disappeared there?
Or... No, just a moment of silence, but yeah, no, yes, we could easily make it differently.
I didn't realize that was odd reverence or technical difficulty there. But
it was.
Sorry, I ruined the moment.
I just took a moment there to think, yes, And you know, he's right. He's right. It only takes the ability to say, no, I'm going to not vote for what you want. And I'm going to tell my next door neighbor, I'm going to tell my mate. And I go down the pub and say, Pete, you know, We shouldn't be doing this, and here's why. And if there enough people do,
yes. If enough people do, yep. Sorry.
We can change the world. Right, we can change
we
the
can.
World. But it takes the courage to stand up and say. And too many people would rather have safety than freedom these days. That is the core and crux of it. I had an argument recently on Facebook with people because they were cheering for the COVID vaccine passport. And I was, this passport will not keep you safe. It is a magic feather that Dumbo uses. Don't be Dumbo. The only thing that this world has that is worth fighting and dying for is freedom and liberty. And so many of our forefathers have fought and died for it to not... fight for it, to willingly give it away is an anathema to me. To remember that Hitler, that Stalin, that Pol Pot, that Che Guevara, all of these people were populists that were cheered in by the adoring public only to bring about absolute nightmarish crap. And it's all the same. Stop giving up your freedom and liberty. Think for yourself and just want freedom. Want freedom for your kids. Want freedom and liberty for your future generations. Think to the future, not for yourself. Not, I want to be safe. Stop buying into the fear that these people sell you, because that's all they can peddle. Fear. That is their only method of control. Stop being afraid.
We've got another donation here, just to before we wrap up, from the Canadian Heston. He's donated $12 Canadian. Thank you for that. He says, how about Blair in the US pumping money to the Pakistani intelligence agency, which used it to buy drugs from the Taliban, or use the cash to arm them and be used against NATO troops? Yeah. Remember, Western countries were helping to kill... Yeah, they were helping to kill their own soldiers, essentially. That is a very true point.
Yes.
There's a couple of things I want to shell before we wrap up. I will have memberships turned on soon. I was hoping to have them ready for this stream today, but I've not had time. We're going to probably tomorrow turn those on. We're going to record a little intro video showing you what the memberships will bring. But yeah, I have a whole suite of memberships, which will come with emotes and badges and all that good stuff for you guys who want to support us. You've been very generous. The viewers have been ramping up. The donations have been ramping up. You guys have been very consistent. I know this is more of a British politics stream, but again, people have been very interested. I like to think of this as almost like the anti-memory hole stream. Really? Because we bring up so much stuff that people don't want to talk about, and we're going to have a lot more stuff focused on historic stuff going forward. I think that's really kind of where we're finding our niche here. It's recontextualizing the reality of today through the established fact of yesterday, because so much of what was a conspiracy theory in the past is now considered proven truth in the present. And we can just demonstrate how that pipeline works to you, because we know, you know, all this stuff we can show you about Tony Blair at the time wasn't apparent. It would have never been elected otherwise.
No.
You know? We have the benefit of hindsight here, but you can almost have hindsight in real time if you studied the past well enough. So that's kind of what we're trying to do moving forward here. Again, I want to give you a little bit of a plug. Trig, you're on Minds. You're still on Twitter somewhat.
I am. I am. Yes. Oh, just quickly, something I forgot to mention. Good God, we forgot to mention this. Tony Blair, in his 10 years of leadership of the UK... doubled the legislation on the books in the UK. So that is 300 or 400 years worth of legislation doubled in 10 years. That sink in. The man put so much legislation through, we don't even know what is law anymore. Because he just shoved everything he could through. In the middle of the night, in the middle of the day, every hour that God sent, he was pushing more and more legislation through.
He really was. He was an absolute... There's a few things... Again, we've kind of run out of time here. There's a few things we haven't covered that we probably will cover in future streams. Because I'm hoping maybe at one point to do a Bush administration special too, which will be very interesting. Because that's going to be... I don't know. It's going to be like... The ghost of late-night television is... they never did the Bush era justice. All they did was talk about surface-level stuff from a leftward perspective. They never actually tackled the real shit. And they gave Obama a pass on the shit that Bush was criticized for. So we'll probably have that at some point. Again, we have the link down below. Please check us out on Minds. Minds is a good platform. We're shilling Minds. It's fun. Come join us. You can actually make a bit of money there as well. I recently cashed out my Minds crypto. It was a bit of a process. It's a bit roundabout. Oh. You need to buy some Ethereum to get your money out. But I made about £60 from shitposting over 3 months.
Wow.
So that's like, I'm making like £20 a month on Mines through Mines tokens. It's crazy. If you cash them out, you know, it's a bit of a roundabout route, like I said, but you can actually make a little bit of money that way. I had nearly 300 of them. So that was, you know, it's quite a large amount, but again, it does snowball. So that's pretty good. I also have my Discord, which is linked down below. I know you guys have joined that. Again, Dev's making content again, finally. So there's a new Dumping with Scrump to check out if you guys haven't seen that already yet. We're still doing Seal of Approval. Seal of Approval's linked down below. I think Trig was on that one yesterday, weren't you?
I was definitely on that one yesterday, yes.
Good. Just checking I haven't had a fucking stroke.
Yeah. You know what? It was nice to actually meet Lilith. I hadn't spoken to Lilith before then. And That was thank you for calling me in on that with 2 minutes, 2 whole minutes of advance notice. So I was
Well, it's just Rose mentioned it. I was like, I guess we're gonna have extra guests on this trick.
No, that was fun.
Thank you guys for joining us. It's gonna be April 1st next week, so we'll probably have some sort of news roundup stream. Not gonna be a specific topic, I think. But yeah. Anything you wanna shill before we end here, Trig?
Not at the moment. I must say, if what we've been discussing is what we're going to be doing over the next sort of 6 or 7 weeks, I guess, I'm really excited for it. I think there's a hell of a lot to research and a hell of a lot of stuff to to do. But yes, no, I'm really looking forward to what we've got coming up. Quite frankly,
there'll be an announcement post tomorrow. But look out for memberships. I will be turning those on, if not tomorrow, then over the weekend. They will come with some extra benefits. Like I said, some emotes, some exclusive community posts, and I think a role in my Discord as well, if I remember the post correctly. So, like I said, if you guys have been very supportive, you want to support us on that, that's great. And thanks for joining us today.
Get the merch store set up.
I may have found someone who can get us merch, so that's going to be fantastic. Coming over the next couple of weeks, I think.
Awesome.
I just went to find someone who wouldn't yeet us, basically.
Yeah, I know. Some of them are a little tasty and spicy.
Like I've had some good reactions too. So look out for merch at some point. I can't make a promise yet. But thank you for joining us, and I will say good night.
And I will say good night too.